It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now we get a look at a farm-to-table restaurant in Door County, recently named a national semifinalist for Outstanding Restaurant in the James Beard Awards. And this is like the Oscars of the restaurant industry. Call in with your questions about exceptional Wisconsin eateries and what makes an excellent dining spot. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mike Holmes is owner of Wickman House, a restaurant in Ellison Bay. Mike, welcome to the Ideas Network and congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Kate. It's really an honor to be here.
What does it mean to you and your staff to be one of 20 restaurants in the country vying for Outstanding Restaurant?
It's unbelievable. It really is. It was a goal of mine. And it's just quite an honor. It's, you know, our staff, the community that we're in, the people that every day, you know, come there and provide the experience that we're able to give to our guests. It's so wonderful to be in this category because it's the whole restaurant. It really is it sums up all the hard work of everybody on our team and everybody that's been on our team in years past.
You say it was a goal, and I wonder, how have you been working toward this moment?
I think, yeah, to say goal, it's an aspiration, maybe. Really wanting to make sure that we're doing everything at the highest level that we can do. We've always wanted to provide one of the most unique experiences to our guests. We keep raising the bar every year, year after year, within our food, within our cocktail, and, you know, within our setting, our garden, our guest service. It's just every year, keep pushing the boundary, keep trying to get better, keep figuring out ways to make it the most unique and special experience to everyone that comes and visits us.
One of those goals has been to really source local ingredients. How have you done with that?
Very well, thank you. Yeah, when we opened Wickman House, that was definitely the goal, knowing that there were so many wonderful farms and gardens surrounding us, and being able to have connections right with those growers, right with those farmers. That was, since day one, that was really where we wanted to go. And we're so thankful that as the years have gone on, we've just met so many more special people doing incredible things, growing incredible vegetables, raising amazing meat. You know, it's just been so wonderful to kind of be able to forge those relationships. And we've also, since 2014, really had a focus on creating our own garden space that to this day is now, our total growing space is just over 12,000 square feet. So we're able to get a lot of our own product right from our backyard. And that's been on our part of our mission since the very beginning.
You know, sourcing locally, that takes time to develop those relationships, and it takes trust that your supply chain will be there when you need it, when you need those ingredients. What is that difficult to ensure that you still have those ingredients when you need them for your dishes?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. You know, it's in restaurants, right? You go through so much product, and the cool thing about working with a farmer, working with a grower, you know, a gardener, is that you can talk through all of these things. You know what they're going to be bringing in. You can know that maybe they had a hard time growing this one specific thing you're asking for, so they're going to replace it with something else. So it's those kind of, because you know your farmer, literally know your farmer and your friends, you can work together to make sure that you're putting the best product out there.
Have you had to tweak or alter your recipes because you can't reliably get certain ingredients? Do you have to be flexible based on what's available, or based on the cost of certain ingredients?
For sure. Our chefs are just so incredibly talented. And so we keep our menus, you know, kind of vague, within not going incredibly specific on what the vegetable will be. So we can be flexible in those dishes when we are able to get squash instead of Brussels sprouts. You know, we really try to make sure that we're not tied to one specific ingredient. And then we, like I said, we just keep we keep our menus rotating. We keep trying to be flexible so we don't run into those problems where we're going to totally run out of something.
The Wickman House in Door County Farm to Table Restaurant, now a national semifinalist for Outstanding Restaurant in the James Beard Awards. Talking with owner Mike Holmes, and you can join the conversation calling with your questions, your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Mike Holmes here, owner of the Wickman House, a restaurant in Door County, named a semifinalist in the restaurant category for a James Beard Award, joining 10 Wisconsin chefs, restaurants, and restaurateurs. Mike's restaurant, the only one named a semifinalist outside Madison and Milwaukee. Be part of the conversation, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Mike, you worked in bars and restaurants in New York for a decade or so. What is different about operating a restaurant here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, definitely. That, you know, I came from a very competitive area within New York and Brooklyn. You know, there's just so much more there, right? There's just so many more there's a lot more competition for the role that you're in. There's a lot more people that are waiting to work with you. And when we moved, you know, when we opened up Wickman House, we thought, hey, you know, this is going to be just like being in New York. You know, it's going to be people knocking down the door to come work with us. And there's, you know, any problem that arises, there'll be 10 people waiting for that job, you know, all that kind of stuff. And we are just so lucky right now that we've created the team that we have, the family that we have within ours, because it's now 11 years later, it's very similar to the operations when I was in Brooklyn, but 11 years ago, that was not the case. We found our way, and it was a fun experiment, and it was been a fun journey transitioning out of the big city back into a small town that, you know, it's a small town, but millions of people come through here in the summer. So it's a really unique setting, and it's been a lot of fun to navigate.
Tourism, though, being seasonal, and you made a little bit of a hint there to the labor market. I mean, we're seeing such a tight labor market across a number of industries. How difficult is hiring and retaining staff?
Yeah, I think the great thing about this area also, and I hope what we're doing with our restaurants is we're creating a place that people want to be. And people love being here in Door County. People, it's an amazing place to live. And it's been fun to create a couple of restaurants where restaurant professionals want to come and share their talent and you know, that's been the coolest thing is really we've found our group. And there's a lot more people here in the summer and the fall, but we found our year round family, and it's really amazing.
Are Wisconsin restaurants back from the pandemic, do you think?
I think that everyone's story is different when it comes to, that's a great question. I think that everyone's story is different. And I think there's, you know, this industry, we all know it was hard to navigate. The first summer of the pandemic, we switched to doing a completely all barbecue menu. We slow smoked briskets and ribs for 16 hours a day. And we were doing takeout and, you know, allowing people to hopefully take some really good meal back to their home while they all figured out what was going on. And I think that the industry is bouncing back, and I think that the industry is different. And I think that what we're seeing that is so cool is that people really have used their creativity. This is an industry of creatives, and people have really used this industry and their creativity to say, hey, we're here. This is how we're going to, you know, go forward. And I do think it's coming back. I really do.
Well, one example of that creativity is what you brought as a bartender in the craft cocktail scene from Brooklyn back to your restaurant. How are you sharing that experience of cocktails and craft cocktails at the Wickman House?
That was really my one of my first passions to bring back to this area was the craft cocktail scene, and it's just been so fun to be able to. We've had really creative bartenders over the years. There's only been about six or seven of us, and we have a cocktail list of about 50 different cocktails. Some are our takes on classics, and some are our completely original. And it's just been really fun to raise the bar, not only in our restaurant to give some, you know, our guests the experience of really having a uniquely crafted drink, but it also is, you know, I think push people to also create that in their own establishment. So as a person who just loves craft cocktails, who's been a bartender for 19 years, I think it's been really fun to see people enjoy the cocktails that we're creating, come to our restaurant to have that experience. And also that it's been fun to go to all these other places too and see their experiments and their creations.
I'm going to reintroduce you here for a moment. We have Mike Holmes, owner of Wickman House in Ellison Bay, as we talk about the James Beard nomination of Door County's Wickman House for Outstanding Restaurant in the awards this year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. So you have a recipe for the Rusty Leaf, which is a variation of the classic Rusty Nail. Can you talk a little bit about what you've created with this cocktail?
Sure. It's a fun drink. A Rusty Nail is kind of my dad and I one time, like when I was, you know, just legal drinking, he showed me a Rusty Nail, and it was a special moment where we were having a great conversation. So it's always kind of been in my heart just a little bit. Mm-hmm. And the cool thing about this drink, and another thing that goes back to the Wickman property, is we have a ton of sugar maples on our property. So we make our own maple syrup. So this drink utilizes maple syrup. And I think that we're going to share it with your guests, maybe on the website too. So, and it's a recipe and a cocktail that I kind of wanted to show, because it's something that you can make at home. And there's so many great places that make amazing maple syrup in the state. So it's a play on the rusty leaf and rusty nail. And it uses our maple syrup, and it uses bitter cube orange bitters and a really smoky scotch, and then a blended scotch. And it's just a really wonderful sipping drink. It's warming. It's perfect for, there's a couple snowflakes coming down out the window right now. It's a perfect drink for this time of year.
What about for people who say, ooh, don't like the scotch aftertaste? not that you have heard that before at all.
No, never, never.
but how do you respond to that?
I think that the maple syrup really kind of comes through, and the use of the bitters rounds it all out. And the best thing about cocktails is there is something for everyone. So if this isn't for you, then there's plenty other ones that we can point you in the direction. But I think that this drink would be a perfect introduction or reintroduction to the Scotch world.
So you're in the company of 14 other chefs and restaurants and restaurateurs with the semifinalist nomination. What does that mean going forward for the business, the reputation, what you put in front of your customers? Because the stakes are even higher. There's an expectation there.
Definitely. I think the exciting thing for us as a team is this does call more attention to the restaurant, and it hopefully calls a few more people that want to be part of our team, a couple other more people that want to be on our journey to create what we're creating. And I think that on that level is amazing. I think that I'm behind the bar again, I'm up front most every day, and I tell you, at 3 minutes to 5, that nervous feeling in my stomach has never gone away in the 11 years. Because we want to always bring our A game. We want to always give the best. So I don't think our service is going to change at all. I don't think our offerings are going to be just what they were. And it's just a great reminder that the hard work that we're all putting in, the hard work that everyone brings every day, is paying off. And it's just a great feeling.
So how do you avoid burnout in an industry with notoriously long hours?
It's a never-ending battle. And what we're trying to do is not just sustainability within food, but sustainability in the lives of all of us, you know, figuring out ways to bring in some more people so we can cut hours back, you know, bringing in more hands so we can continue to bring out the excellent product and not have burnout. You know, that's a huge focus of mine. It's a huge focus of our team, you know, and it's a work in progress every year.
And I'm sure that your restaurant is always on your mind, though.
Oh, yeah. It's my child. It's my life. You know, like I say it and I mean it. My team is my family, and that's, you know. So of course, just like everyone's family, you think about them all the time, and that can be a wonderful thing as well.
Mike, thank you for joining us. All the best.
Thank you, Kate. Appreciate it.
Mike Holmes is owner of the Wickman House, a restaurant in Ellison Bay, Door County. 2023 James Beard Award winners will be named at an award ceremony in Chicago on June 5th. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now we explore the work of the Slippage Lab at Northwestern University, elevating the Black experience through dance and connecting it across disciplines, and in the process, engaging creativity for the common good and lifting up underrepresented voices in the arts. Call in with your questions about African-American identity through dance, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Thomas DeFrance is a professor in the School of Communication at Northwestern, where Thomas directs the Slippage Research Group. Thomas, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, and thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Good morning. So you plan to use $500,000 in this new grant funding to look more closely at Black dance practices across the country. What questions do you hope to answer?
Oh my goodness, so many. We have so many just amazing things that come from Black forms of expression, and in particular dance, which is the thing that I am most concerned with in this particular grant. So we wonder how people understand place and place as a way to move towards freedom. I think that's the main way that we're thinking about what the grant is for and what we're up to in the lab and our work over the next few years.
Where will that take you? Where will you be able to travel outside of, you know, Northwestern to be able to understand that?
That's a great point. And one of the things that was interesting about this particular project, we've been very concerned with Black forms of creativity and dance, you know, for our, you know, 15 years of operation in the Slippage Lab. But for this particular project, we decided to choose six cities. And what was interesting when I was working with Shireen Dixon, the managing director of the lab, we realized very quickly that we could pretty much choose any city in the United States and find a vibrant and important site of Black creativity and Black dance. That said, the six we chose are, drum roll please, Chicago, of course, because
sure,
we're based here in Chicago, devastated. Then moving northward, Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And in Minneapolis, we want to look at the Black queer and drag ball scene in Minneapolis. So that might be a bit of a surprise to people that there is a vibrant scene there, and we're curious about what's happening there. Then we'll head over to visit our friends in Detroit, which has an amazingly robust JIT dance scene that's been in operation for at least 10 years. Moving south, we'll go to Atlanta, where pretty much everything happens in Atlanta. We'll be able to engage with all kinds of communities of dance there. We'll go out further west to Los Angeles, which of course also has created any number of important forms of Black dance that are still in circulation globally. And finally, for something a little bit different, we thought we'd move all the way down to Miami to take some attention and temperature of Black and Latinx sort of collaborations. Black dance is an aspect of reggaeton and how these formations are actually in conversation, producing other sort of embodied actions of freedom.
Can you make some connections to dance in caring for and supporting the Black Lives Matter movement?
Yes, I certainly can. One thing we noticed all throughout the pandemic when the largest protests were happening was how central dance had become. So people who had been locked up, you know, we'd been quarantined and held back from our public sort of presences and public celebrations. And as we gathered in these protests for the last 2 or 3 years, dance became a kind of always there-ness. There was always dance in the protests. So the Slippage Group, in collaboration with CAD, the Collegium for African Diaspora Dance, started accounting for how dance was being mobilized as an aspect of social justice for this generation of people who are dancing and protesting. So there's a way that dance has always been aligned with Black life and Black creativity, and also Black protest. And these generations that are dancing now over the last 10 years or so in this social justice movement are deploying dance as a way to express pain, submerged traumas, but also resiliency, powerfulness, and a willingness to keep going.
It can express so much. You can express so much in movement. How do you make these connections to dance with history and technology and performance? And, you know, on the technology bit, like, I learned that your undergrad, you had a minor in computer science. You know, in my crack sleuthing. But I how do you connect dance with technology?
Oh my gosh, that's funny. That's actually true. I've been really concerned with keeping left and right brain sorts of operations moving among each other as best I can. Well, I want to start by saying that dance is a technology, and dance is a technology of feeling. And one way we know this to be true is that when we dance, we feel differently. So dance actually gives us a roadmap for how a sort of organization of energy, you know, whatever you're doing that you're calling dance, it is guaranteed to make you feel differently. So however you were feeling before you danced, you'll feel something else after you dance or while you dance. So dance already is a technology, and it's taken me a while to sort of come around to that point of view. There were lots of researchers saying that 50 or 75 years ago. But for me, it really was just only the last 2 or 3 years that I felt convinced that this was a reasonable way to move that idea forward. Now, in terms of actual technology that we might, you know, buy at a store or develop it in our own little workshops at home, we do things like we hack the VR headsets so that groups of people can see what's happening inside one of the headsets while someone's dancing. So we can create these different ways to understand how dance, how it propels itself outward and what dance can do. So we have all kinds of little tricks that we're after in terms of responsive environments or responsive wearable technologies that we develop in the lab to help us understand how dance might be organized.
We're talking with Northwestern University professor Thomas DeFrance, leads the Slippage Lab, which explores these connections between performance and theater and emergent technology. Join our conversation, calling with your questions, your comments on the universe of dance, dance steps, communication through movement, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Northwestern University dance professor Thomas DeFrance, who directs the Slippage Lab, taking this interdisciplinary approach to Black dance and connecting it to history and theater and technology. Still time to share your thoughts and ask questions. 800-642-1234. Thomas, let's turn our attention to teaching hip-hop and how you connect hip-hop with history and the industrial prison complex and urban renewal and multiculturalism with dance practices. Can you give us an example how hip-hop dance practices, you know, connect with these things?
Well, it is pretty amazing how dance can become a lever for understanding how people live their lives. Hip-hop, like jazz before it, is maybe a kind of umbrella constellation of activity. So we say hip-hop, and we're thinking of maybe popping and locking, breaking, six steps, capoeira, repurposed through certain kinds of rhythms to become something else. So hip-hop is a cultural formation that includes maybe crumping, maybe b-girling and b-boying. So all these different kinds of ways to move. And these movements are forms that young Black people create so that we can express. So there's kind of a way that our dances are always embedded in questions of access to healthy food or healthcare, or to good educational processes, or better teachers and infrastructure. Our dances are constantly telling stories about what it's like to be in the spaces of the carceral state or the space of a police state. So we have dances like hip hop, which is especially hard-edged and weighted in its formations, like the dancing is hard, like you're preparing yourself for battle. And these dances emerge exactly at the moment that the US police state seems to take a turn against Black Americans in the 1980s. So we can look historically at what sorts of Black dances developed in any historical period and what was happening surrounding the Black people who were dancing these dances. We can see these relationships, and they help us understand how history and culture have been fomented.
What about the collision of Black dance in other forms of dance? And I'm just wondering how you see the Black experience and Black dance informing modern, you know, contemporary ballet.
Oh, that's such a great question. And it is sort of one of my own personal areas of research interest. I do think that there's a way that Black affect, or the ways that African Americans essentially narrate the worlds we inhabit through our movements. So how we move, how we might turn the neck or circle a shoulder or shimmy or drop towards our knees with our weight. These are ways to move that we might recognize as Black movements. And they show up in ballet, and they show up in modern dance, and they certainly show up on Broadway or in contemporary filmmaking or music videos. So these ways to move become shared languages that populations all across the planet engage in. And that's what's so interesting to me, is that these are Black forms of movement that then become common forms that are practiced by people in India, or our friends who are recovering in Turkey and Syria, or in Haiti, of course, but also in Sweden or in Alaska.
How well are choreographers incorporating historically significant Black dance practices into their performances?
Yes, very well, I would say. We see this all the time, everywhere. You know, there's a question about paying attention and compensation. So is there actually kind of the financial return? And we saw this in TikTok when there were some young Black creators who were developing dances on TikTok, but they were not being compensated for these forms that were shared around the planet. And then other sort of, I'm not sure what that word is, trenders or influencers. I guess, on TikTok. The influencers were able to receive money and goods, while the young Black creatives were not. But we only know about that because a protest was raised and there was some sort of retribution. You know, some of these young Black creatives were at least paid a tiny compensation for their creative work. But it's just an example of how Black dance forms have so much broad appeal, and so many people from many different places on the planet get excited about these different forms that come from this culture.
Talking about dance with Thomas DeFrance, a Northwestern University professor studying Black dance practices. You can join in along the way, 800-642-1234. Howard in Portage. Hi, Howard, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I'm wondering if the professor is familiar or has worked with Agba Ja from Ghana, which is a piece of music, or maybe many pieces of music, that based on a percussion ensemble, bridges jazz and Latin American drumming, and of course comes with a dance, or many dances. Prominent piece of music for me in my life.
Howard, thank you. Thomas.
Thank you so much for that question. And the Collegium for African Diaspora Dance has several African dance experts on its board of directors. So I know that in my close group of colleagues and research affiliates, we have folks who are directing the African American Dance Ensemble and directing Dance Black Africa in America, which is a huge festival that travels around the United States. So while the Ghanaian forms are definitely not my area of expertise, I do have on speed dial researchers who have ways to think about these forms. And I'm just so glad to hear that that particular form and constellation of dance and music has been important to you in your life. This is why we make art, is to share it and help people figure things out that they need to know. So I'm glad to hear you mention this particular Ghanaian form that has such a presence in the U.S. now.
Is there documentation? Is there enough written knowledge about these particular dance forms that to ensure that they are not forgotten or that they can be continued on?
This is exactly why we formed the Collegium for African Diaspora Dance. So this group started with 12 researchers, including myself, in 2012. So 10, 11 years ago now. And we went from 12 people to about 350 now. And these are all researchers who work on Black dance or African diaspora dance and its formations, and translating these gestures into writing or into video lectures, or into, now we're trying to think about modeling AI systems so that we can share this information and be sure, to your point, that the stories of these dances can be told and told again.
Thomas, thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Thomas DeFrance is a professor in Northwestern University's School of Communication and director of the Slippage Research Group. We have a link at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.